This week is Parshas Pinchas, page 876 in the article Chumash. Pinchas has in it a number of pieces of narrative, interspersed with other elements, and then it moves on towards the end of the parsha into the components which we're familiar with from the Torah reading on Rosh Chodesh, and all of the maftirs of many of the Yom Tovim appear in the end of Parshas Pinchas. So that really starts with Chamishi and carries through to the end of the Parsha. The components which are narrative are the very first story, which is really a spillover from last week's Parsha. Last week's Parsha ended with the plague that began when the Midianite and Moabite women enticed the Bnei Yisrael, and it concluded with the story of Zimri taking the princess of Moab. I'm sorry, the Midianite princess, whatever it was, she was, Cozbi, and Pinchas killed them, and that ended the plague. So the parsha here begins with, in the immediate aftermath of that, when Pinchas is given a reward for that which he had done. Then there is a census which is made in the beginning of chapter 26. And all the tribes are essentially counted, and we're given a number which is significantly different than the number which we kept on seeing earlier in the Torah. A couple times we saw a number which was 603,550, and the final number which we have over here is 601,730. So this, of course, follows, because there have been so many plagues and people dying, that the number would be less. I believe that there is another census in the Torah where the number is higher, but I don't remember where that one is. Anyway, so we're given that. And the last piece of narrative here, it's really two pieces of narrative. One is the daughters of Tzlafchad, when they come over to Moshe and they say, our father died in the wilderness, and he doesn't have any sons, and so it's just us. And if we don't have we're not married, if we don't have a place to live in the land, you know, then what are we going to do? If you're going to give his land over to other family members, to brothers which he may have, to other male relatives, what are we left to do? And a law is essentially taught here. There's a debate whether the law was known beforehand, or whether Moshe forgot the law, or whether it was just given at this time. I mean, of course, it doesn't make sense that it would be given at this time. It was given at the time of the Torah, but it's recorded in the Torah at this time, essentially tying it to the daughters of Tzlafchad, and that is that daughters can inherit if there is no son. But in any case, you know, the Torah certainly is ascribing to a certain kind of patriarchal system, in the sense that it's assumed that the daughters are getting married and they're joining their husbands' families, and that in the event that they're not, that the men of their household will be taking care of them. And shortly after that, the Torah concludes with Moshe facing the reality that the Bnei Israel are going to be left without a leader, because he does not have somebody replacing him yet. His brother had recently died in Parshas Chukas. We saw the death of Aaron. And who replaced Aaron as the Kohen Gadol? Aaron's son. Okay, so Moshe has sons, but they're not really in the picture. So who's going to replace Moshe? So Moshe turns to God, and God's answer is, you have a protege, and his name is Yehoshua, and that's the guy. So Moshe is given the instructions to do smicha, to basically put some of Moshe's glory onto Yehoshua, and he's essentially beginning the training the minds of the people to realize that however they revere Moshe, however they honor Moshe, however they respect Moshe, that needs to be transferred to Yehoshua. And it begins still in Moshe's lifetime that people see that Yehoshua is taking over. And that helps to ease the transition, so that when Moshe does pass away, at the end of the Torah, Yehoshua is immediately seen as the leader, and the mantle is clearly passed. So what I want to do today is look at just a few pieces of both the narrative, which I just kind of summarized, and then some of the things related to the maftirs, or the different components of Yom Tovim. Obviously, we can't get through everything, but through the eyes of the Ksav HaKabal. So we're going to start again on page 876, where Hashem says the following to Moshe. Yidaber Hashem Moshe l'Emor. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Heshiv Eschem Asi, Mi'al Bnei Yisrael, B'Kanoos K'nasim Socham, V'lo Chlis Yis Bnei Yisrael, B'Kinasi. Pinchas was the son of Aaron, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron. He turned back my wrath from upon the children of Israel when he zealously avenged my vengeance among them. So I did not consume the children of Israel in my vengeance. Remember, God had caused the deaths of 24,000, and the plague ended when Pinchas did what he did. Lachain emor hinani no saying lo es berisi shalom. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace. Okay, and what that covenant of peace means, it has different components to it, but essentially the most important thing to know is that Pinchas, being born when he was born, and being of a certain generation, when Aaron and his sons were consecrated to become Kohanim, so that was a consecration only for Aaron and his sons, the generation immediately below him. Nobody else became Kohanim at that time. Anyone who was born already at that time was not a Kohen, but anyone who would be born from their line afterwards would be a Kohen by birth. So Pinchas had already been born. We see Pinchas's existence mentioned in Parshas Va'era. There's a brief genealogy there of the families of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, but once it gets into Levi, it goes all the way through to Moshe and Aaron. And in Aaron's case, it mentions his children, and of course Pinchas as well. So we know that Pinchas has been around for a while, but Pinchas he was the opposite of grandfathered in, right? He was grandfathered out, in the English way of saying that. So Pinchas was out. But after this episode, when Pinchas carried out the law as it's supposed to be, so Pinchas was given the covenant of peace, which on the one hand meant that he was going to be a Kohen Gadol, that he was a Kohen, and that he could take over for his father eventually, which he does in the book of Shoftim. Pinchas is the Kohen Gadol, okay, and then, or at least at the outset, and then, and the other component is that Pinchas sets a precedent for all time that the Kohanim are actually not supposed to be the people who carry out these kinds of laws, that the only death that a Kohen is really allowed to be associated with is the death of an animal as part of a korban. Okay, aside from a law which we saw in Parshas Emor, that a Kohen can only become tameh to a relative of his who has died, but he's really not supposed to be involved in these kinds of activities. Now, there are exceptions, of course, a melchemes mitzvah, a mitzvah war, where they need to go out so everybody can go out to fight. But beyond that, this is not really their role. And that's what the covenant of peace is. The Kohen is supposed to represent peacefulness and peace in general. So playing this kind of a role is something which becomes antithetical to what a Kohen is supposed to be.
Why did they have a Kohen in charge of war?
Why did they have I don't know entirely what his role is, except that what I do know is that part of what would take place on the battlefield was determined by God's guidance. And the Kohen Gadol, in wearing the Choshen, in those kinds of contexts, could be the recipient of questions. Meaning the Choshen would be the recipient of questions. And we see this, by the way, in both the book of Shoftim and certainly the book of Shmuel, on a number of occasions, where the Kohen is asked the question, should we go out to war? And when the answer is no, they're not supposed to go out to war. In some cases, the answer was no, and they went out anyway. They got walloped. So that's one component to it. Another component to it might be that's similar to a chaplain. People, they need that connection. Now, I'm not saying that might be more of a psychological, reason as opposed to a rules reason. But the Kohen represents something. And it wasn't always, by the way, that the Kohen who went out to war was the main Kohen Gadol. You had a Kohen who was a Mashuach Milchama, who was anointed to be a Kohen Gadol specifically for war. So that would be a different person. It wouldn't necessarily be the Kohen who was the one who was doing the whatever service he does in the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, we move on here to Esprisi Shalom. So we're going to look at the Haksav HaKabbalah, And what he says here in terms of what is the significance of this covenant of peace that Pinchas was given. Okay, so the first thing which he says is Ayin Rashi the Reish Beis Ches. I'm not sure who Rish Ben Yitzchak could be Rabbeinu Bechaye, could be Rabbeinu Chaye, Rabbeinu Chanan, I'm not sure. But he says, Amar, Al Derech HaPshat, Hemtichu Bebrish Shalom, Shelo Yifached Ma'achei Zimri, Shelo Yinechamu Nikmaso. So the first thing that he's promised, Hemticho Bebrish Shalom, the covenant of peace, which is given to Pinchas, is the covenant that he should not be worried about Zimri's relatives. And, I mean, Pinchas essentially killed Zimri, one could argue, in cold blood, and his relatives have the right to enact vengeance. Well, right. So the first thing that he says is that the A definition of the Brit Shalom, we've already talked about a couple others, but A definition of the Brit Shalom is that nobody's gonna get him back. And you know, what does that sound like, by the way? Who was responsible for killing somebody and was given a promise that he wouldn't be killed by others, even though eventually he was? Anyone remember? The first murderer in the Torah. Who's that?
Cain.
Cain, right? Right? Kol motzai yehargeni, right? Everybody who finds me is going to kill me. So God gives Cain an os, right? Whatever that means, he gives him a sign. But people are not allowed to kill you. Ma yescharu al zeh, amar v'hayis alo l'zaru acharav, gomer shakuna tielo nitzchis. So what's his reward? That he becomes a Cain. That he becomes a Cain because he was not a Cain at the time that the kahuna was established. V'linir mila shalom nigzar mipal shalim. That shalom doesn't specifically mean peace, but it comes from the word shalem as well. What he did, his horah, in other words, his insight that this is what needs to be done was affirmed essentially that you were shalem and tamim in what you did, complete and perfect in the way in which he carried out the law. Kishen nimtzalo kulo. That is, you know, when the law is done properly, when there's nothing missing. But I'm skipping that parenthesis word. And our rabbis understood it to mean that he has the covenant. What's this covenant of shalom? It's shlemus haguf. That there's no mum. What does that mean? Amru shalom kamo shalem. The Havav Ketia. Oh, that's interesting. I forgot about that. That is a rule. If you look in an actual Torah, if you look in an actual Torah, that is correct. That Vav is supposed to have a hole in it. It's supposed to be what's called Vav Ketia. Cut a.
I found it many times in my laning. The fact that it's whole. Because somebody who's laning didn't realize that. If it's supposed to be that way, says, oh, it's the Vav is,
Right.
So I asked my Rav, by passing the shoulder. So I said, one time I was waiting for him, and I found it. So what we do? He says, just take,
a little blade and just...
A little blade and just take it.
Yeah.
That's all
you can
do.
Right. Yeah.
I look at a lot of those different Torahs.
Okay, right. Okay. V'liyosha Torah b'mitzvoseh, tavi al tachli shleimiyus hanafshiyus, amar shlomo ala v'chol nasiyah v'seh shalom. Okay, so the... So I'm not clear on the way that he's taking it to that message of Shlemus Haguf Bilti Mum. Is that referring to Pinchas? I mean, is Pinchas' Guf, which is Bili Mum, but he's not really explaining that. But he's saying what the Torah is meant to represent is that Chol Nasiyah Seh Shalom. What does it mean that the Torah's ways are the ways of peace, or is Shalom doesn't only mean peace? Shalom means complete. But if you think about it, I mean, I've always loved when you ask little kids, what does the word shalom mean? Okay, so, you know, they're always taught in school, what they're told. There's three translations, right?
Yeah.
Which are peace, hello, and goodbye. Okay? But that's not true. That's not what shalom doesn't mean, hello and goodbye. Shalom means peace. You know the etymology of the word goodbye? This is, you know, I learned this a couple years ago. Goodbye is not a real word. Goodbye comes from the words, God be with ye. God be with ye.
Ooh, wow.
Okay, God be with ye. Okay, which essentially means, in other words in English, go in peace. Okay, God be with ye. So goodbye was just a contraction of the words, God be with ye, which means go in peace. What is hello? Salam. What does it mean? Shalom Aleichem. What does it mean? Not hello. Peace upon you. Okay? That's shalom. But shalom also comes from the word shalem. And so what he's saying here is that what Pinchas is that the blessing that came to Pinchas was about shalom, yes, but also about shleimus, that he should be complete. And in Pinchas's case, owing that he was, you know, the old joke, a guy comes to the rabbi and he says, "Can you make me into a kohen?" Right? The punchline is, "Why do you want to be a kohen so much?" He wants to pay. Because my father was a kohen, my grandfather was a kohen, right? Pinchas could actually make that argument, and he wasn't a kohen, right? He says, "My father was a kohen, my grandfather was a kohen. So how come you're not a kohen?" Okay, well, that's it. So he gets the bris shalom. V'amru b'sifrei, al v'yaseim l'cha shalom, ze shalom Torah. Right? When the blessing that the kohanim give is that v'yaseim l'cha shalom, what does it mean? Shalom Torah. What does it mean? Shalom, the peace of the Torah? What does it mean? Shleimus haTorah. V'liosohu yisbarach ha-shalem b'emes b'chol minei shleimus b'tuar b'shem shalom. God has given the name shalom. But again, what does the word shalom mean? V'yikarelo Hashem shalom. V'yomro Hashem gufei yikrei shalom. So these are just different passages which talk about how God's name is shalom. V'yinei ha-kavanah al-yonah yisbarach she'yishtalmu bro'av u'b'prat min ha-adam. That people should become complete. That's what this is all about. So if you think about what Pinchas is achieving for on many levels a personal completion, because being the person whose father was a Kohen and his grandfather was a Kohen, he really wants to be a Kohen, so he becomes Shalem in that way. Being that his action is affirmed by God as being the correct action, so he's Shalem in that he's an Oved Hashem, he's an Eved Hashem, he's a servant of God. He's Shalem in that way. Sheyishamesh Kol kochosava gashmius v'nefashios l'salos madrigash fela shuba el madrigo yotel el yono. What does it mean for a person to achieve shleimus, completion? Is that a person should use all one's physical powers, spiritual powers, to raise up from being a nobody, a nothing, to a higher madriga, to a higher level. Uvahagio el madrigazo mechuvan bo. And when a person achieves that, he shleimuso. Right, what does it mean for a person to become shleim? When a person achieves one's potential, it's like the Jewish version of the Peter principle. Right, what's the Peter principle? That you rise to the level of your incompetence. That's the opposite. That's the opposite of in Judaism. What do you rise to? You rise to the level of what your potential is. What your potential is. So there's some people whose potential is to go only so far. That's fine. There's some people whose potential is so much greater. Shebezehu shalem tamim shein chasr lo od, there's nothing missing. I mean, can you imagine what does it mean? We know, for example, right, we look at some of the great Rosh Yeshiva and the minds which they have. We know most people don't have that gift. You know, it's just an incredible gift. So if we say, oh, you know, you could be the next Rabbi Akiva Eiger. No, I don't know that I could be the next Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Okay, but you have to, right, it's the old Rabbi Zusha story, right? Rabbi Zusha's on his deathbed and he's crying. His students say, "Why are you crying? You're such an accomplished teacher and everything." He says, "I'm not afraid if Rabbanu Shalom is going to ask me how come you weren't Rashi or the Rambam. I'm afraid if he says how come you weren't Zusha. You didn't achieve your own potential." But that's the point here, that everybody has to achieve for themselves whatever there is their Zusha, not to become something which they're not meant to become.
That's really a hard concept because. How do you know what your potential is? You know, you can try, you can try, you can try, and then, you know, I'm trying, but I'm not getting anywhere. I mean, so, you know.
So it's a good question, but the answer is, are you really trying? Look, like I said before, there are some, not everybody's going to become Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Not everybody's going to go. Not everybody's, and that's fine. We don't need everybody. That would be really not good. Some people are meant to be leaders and teachers, and some people are meant to be students and followers. And you know, there's only one way that a shepherd can be a shepherd. He needs to have sheep. Okay, it's, you know, there's a joke the opposite direction between the president of the United States and the prime minister of Israel. Where the prime minister is like all fishmatted, and the president looks, you know, the way that he looks like all fun and laughing, and everything is all good, and so the prime minister says to the president, the president says to the prime minister of Israel, "How many people do you have in your country?" So the joke at the time was 2 million. It's a golden mayor. It's said about every prime minister. How many people do you have in your country? So now he would say 8 million. And how many do you have in your country? 300-something million. So he says, 300-something million, and you look like the way you do? How come? And so the I don't remember who asked who the question, but the answer is, you're the president for over 300 million citizens. I'm the prime minister over 8 million people who are think they're prime minister. Whatever. Okay? So that's the joke. Anyway, but that's the point. You can't, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. That's not the way, you know, the human condition functions normally. That's the, now, again, people shouldn't be totalitarian, you know, dictators and all that. That's also not really good for the human condition. But the point is that each person has the opportunity to achieve their shleimus. And what their shleimus is you know, there's a Jack Benny, oh, so Benny Kubelski. Don't insult me. So Jack Benny and Mel Blanc, Al Vashalom, they had a very amazing relationship. Okay, in addition to working together, they were very good friends. So in one episode of the Jack Benny program, Mel Blanc comes out and he's wearing a taxi man's uniform. So he's pretending he's a taxi guy who's going to come pick up Jack Benny, and he says, he looks at me and he says, do I know you? And so Mel Blanc, playing some character, says, yeah, I was so-and-so, top of the class, voted most likely to succeed. And wouldn't you know it, I own my own cab. You know, it's great. It's fantastic. Okay, so, you know, in that character, what she's saying, that's my shleimus. That's my shleimus.
That's okay. Great that is. What? That's
deep. Yeah, well, that's the point. Hasagah shleimus is that yesh lo madrigo shenos. B'nei no, are you all with me? Where I left off. He says, the Noachides, they have to keep their seven mitzvahs. That's their, and if they do that good, right, you, if they do that well, find me a Ben Noach, a Noachide, who follows the seven mitzvahs to Noach properly, who's not a mensch. Okay, that's their job. And that's okay. They don't need to keep the laws of kosher. Except for Avraham and Achai. They don't need to, you know, they don't need to keep Shabbos. You know, it's not their job. And that's how they can achieve their shleimus. Again, what kind of shleimus are we talking about? Where maybe this is a spiritual shleimus. I don't know. But the point is that's a shleimus. If he's a Ben Noach and he doesn't follow that, then there's something missing in his not achieving his shleimus. Now, I mean, you know, you can start saying, is this a racist thing? Or that's all his potential? But he's looking at it from I would imagine, a Ruchnius kind of perspective, that you're a Ben Noach, you have responsibilities ad kan, and beyond that. And if you achieve that, shkayach, amazing. Ashleimus Zemar, Bekorasei Lel Shalom, Shu Kolel Bein Shalom Hamidini, and Itzrach, L'Chevras Bnei Adam, Bein Shalom Hamnashi, right? There's the country, the national one that people need in order to live together, and then there's the personal, the spiritual kind of shleimus. And again, the point is that he's trying to make here is that the word shalom shouldn't automatically be translated to mean peace. They have to keep the seven mitzvahs bnei noach. V'chein haYisraeli. So for a Jew, what's the Jew's responsibility to achieve shleimus? To do mitzvos. So if a Jew who's keeping mitzvos has achieved an element of shleimus, I mean, that's what he says, shleimus, he's shleim. V'akohen, af shekiyem kol mitzvos amutalos al Yisrael, a Kohen who does all the mitzvahs that every Jew is supposed to have, do. A Kohen also has Kohen mitzvahs. Okay, in other words, what he's essentially saying is that there is a difference between a Nefesh Yisrael and a Nefesh Kohen. Can you imagine? You know, we nowadays don't understand such a thing. I mean, we still, to a certain degree, practice it because we honor the Kohen more, and a Kohen is not supposed to come in contact with dead bodies. A Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. Right? These are ways in which the Kohen's nefesh is on a level up. So for Pinchas, you know, in particular, this is what his, this was the reward that he was given, that his nefesh somehow undertook new qualities, because otherwise he was mechusar shleim was nafshel, he was dar yesh lam seder. Okay, so I just read that. Yada ki zera Aaron nafsho samuch sharos bekochos yikaros b'shiur rav yoter mikol shar zera Israel. He says the descendants of Aaron, their nefesh, their soul, is muhshar. I mean, it's created with more precious, more valuable kochos, with strength, than other than the Zer Yisrael. And that's why they have more mitzvos than everybody else. And and a kohen who takes this seriously can achieve. I mean, it's probably a little harder, in a place like where we live outside of Israel, for a kohen, because in Israel the kohanim they give brachos every day, for example. Like their status is felt. They don't only need to get an aliyah to say, okay, I'm a kohen today. Right? Their status is felt all on a daily basis, and therefore, you know, there's an honor which is given, and therefore, I remember when I was in yeshiva. I had a roommate who was a kohen, and he happened to be a very quiet and humble guy, a really special fellow. But I think that he embraced, this is just my perception, that he embraced his kohen status in Israel on a level that I think just elevated the way he conducted himself in general. I mean, he was a really solid guy to begin with, but I sensed that. Now, I could be making that up, but I really did feel that he took that very seriously. Pinchas was a descendant of Aaron, and yet, until this happened, he was like every other Yisrael, every other Jew. You know, there's only so much potential that he can achieve. But through doing this action, his nefesh went up levels. And his entire essence changed. So his completeness, his shleimus was elevated, and the opportunity to achieve that was elevated. V'kiyum mitzvos hamutalos al hakohen hu shalomo klamar shleimus nafsho. That's his shalom. What does it mean? You want to translate it as peace? The Ksav HaKabbalah is arguing it's not peace, meaning he can be at peace now that he can achieve all of his shleimus. But it's all about shleimus. The nefesh could achieve so much. So, I mean, to answer your question, Yisrael, the answer is, what is a shleimus for a Jew? To fulfill the mitzvos. That's what it is. It's not, you know, I mean, I gave an example of Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Vilna Gaon. That's filling their, you know, their mitzvos, and in particular their Torah knowledge, that mitzvah, to the level that they're gifted to and that they're able to do. Okay? What?
Gives them loftiness.
Right. But the point is that for every Jew is capable to do mitzvos. Okay? You don't need to be Rabbi Akiva Eiger to put on tefillin if you're a man. You don't need to be a Vilna Gaon to put a mezuzah on your doorway. Okay? I mean, these are things which we're able to do. And so that's the point here. That for in the Ksav HaKabbalah's viewpoint, that we have to remember that the word shalom has a root, and the root is shalem, and shalem means complete. I mean, can you imagine? Think about, you know, the state of Israel today. What does everybody want in Israel? Shalom, right? Peace. And if they had shalom, then the state of Israel would be shalem. It would be complete. Right? What else is needed there? What else is needed there? Now, it's not that it would be complete. It would mean that the people can now really achieve their potential without the worry of rockets, bombs, bullets, knives, etc. Not constantly. People in Israel, thank God, they live their lives, by and large, without worrying about what's behind their back. But wouldn't it be so much greater? Okay. The next one is a short one, and I just wanted to show you the distinction which he makes here between different words which are used to describe the nation. So if you look at the last pasuk in this first section here in the Parsha, So after telling us that the man who Pinchas killed was Zimri, it says Shein Ha'isham Ukam Yanis Kozbi Bas Tzur, that the woman that was with Zimri, her name was Kozbi, Rosh Umos Base of Bimidyanhu, that who was her father, Tzur. He was the head of the peoples of a father's house in Midian. Okay, that's what it means. So, what is Umos? So, article translates Umos to be a people. Right? Rosh Umos, the head of the peoples. So, the Ksava Kabbalah says, let's take a look at this word. And the truth is that we've had this a number of times over the last few parshas where you see these different words being used to describe a nation. So, I just thought this was interesting definitionally. Insofar as the fact that we see these phrases all the time, but there is a difference to be made and taken from them. And when you just look at the translation and you see people, nation, right, you lose the Hebrew differentiation between what those different words mean. Rosh Umos, kol kibbutz gadol shel bnei adam sheyesh lo minhagim nimusim miyuchadim nikra am. Anytime there's a large group which gathers and they have different. They have customs which are special and unique to them. They're called an Am, which he translates into German as Volk. Volk, F-O-L-K, right? Volk, Volk.
Maybe it's F-A-L-K, Volk.
What's that?
People.
I'm saying, but for us, we would translate that to English. No, it may be in German spelled that way. But I'm saying in English. Look at the next one. Natian. Nation. Nation, right? That's what an Am is. Right, people who are defined by customs, by a certain character. What's that word in German? Stadt. State. Okay? If what binds them together is not a custom or a way of life, but is laws, then they become a state. It's not about, it's like, for example, we can talk about. That's the difference between, for example, the United States of America and, you know, some place where the people are all homogeneous. You know, pick a country where everybody's the same. Okay? I don't know, maybe some of the Nordic countries, maybe Russia to a certain degree. Okay, that you have the Russian people. Okay, in America, what makes people Americans is not a common culture. It's a set of laws. Okay? You don't have to look a certain way to be an American. Okay, there are some people who can never become, you know, pick a kind of nation where everybody looks a certain way. You know, you can't become a Chinese or a Japanese. You can't. Okay, that's a culture. That's a certain kind of nation that has. You could try. But
Uruguay, okay, of course, we know it's a nation or it's a state. Where did we get the expression of a goy as a person who's non-Jewish?
I think it comes from a Yiddish. It's a Yiddish. It's a Yiddish. I don't want to call it a diminutive, but it's. But I mean, it's goy, kahal goyim, right? I mean, it's the people of the nations. So to call anybody that, I mean, you know, Am Yisrael is also a goy kadosh, right? So to say, I don't know the etymology of it. I don't know.
No, but just because I remember as well in the Philippines that Sephardim, my parents and the relatives.
All right. So that's what a goy is: people who are bound together by laws. Kingdom. Okay, when you have one person who rules, that's a kingdom. Okay, that's what that is. Okay, biyad ish echad, a king, a duke, or whatever, whoever is in charge of that place, which is not a president. I mean, at least not in the United States terms of a president. This is not a kingdom because it's not one person. We give a lot of prestige and we give a lot of honor to the office of the president, depending on who's occupying it a little more, a little less. But everybody knows that the executive branch is the executive branch, whereas the Congress is the legislative branch. The legislative branch. So So that's so the United States would not be a mamlacha. Uchashibiyad anashim rabim.
England maybe not be a mamlacha.
All right, okay, could be.
You know,
so that's the next one. Uchashihi miyad anashim rabim unisichim yikare. I don't know how to pronounce that. Is that masicha? Aristocratia. Okay, we know what that means, right? Aristocratia. So you have another group called. So I'm not familiar with that word when it comes to describing a nation. Mischa, masicha. I don't know. Uchshiya goy moshel alamim v'goyim rabim yikarei goy moshel be'eretz. So this sounds like an empire, right? Uchshiya goy moshel alamim. So one nation is ruling, or a state rules over a bunch of different nations and a bunch of different nations and a bunch of different states. Yikarei goy moshel be'eretz shara amim amnagim al piv b'shem uma. Okay, so Achashverosh in his paras umadai ruling over 127 midinos. He was an ummah, milashon aim, shehi be'erech alehem ke'erech aim al habanim. Mother folk, right? Mother folk, which means like motherland. Okay, so when you talk about an ummah, so I guess that's what Hitler was trying to create, lahavdil. Okay, he wanted to make everything Germany, but understanding that this is Romania, this is Austria, this is Hungary, and this is Bulgaria, and this is France, and this is Spain. This is, you know, that's what he wanted to do. So he was trying to create a huge ummah. A huge ummah. I don't think that he was really cared that much about the Hebrew definition of what he was trying to do, but that's what he was trying to do. V'chol ha-kibbutz kulo yikarei l'om. God, look at the translation of that. A reich. That's what he was trying to create. Okay? V'kamo u'l'om mil'om ye'ematz. So, but you see how it's interesting that the word ummah comes from a mother who's going to be over this one, over this one, over this one. You can all create your little families, but the bottom line is, I'm the matriarch, right? That's I'm the matriarch of the family. So, I'm not taking much from here beyond that he's defining these different words for us, and depending on the context in the Torah, this would be a great thing to leave, like, you know, as a little scrap of paper in your chumash somewhere. That every time the word comes about, is it consistently following the definitions which he's giving us here? So I certainly did not do that homework. I would say it's homework for all of us, but to understand, because sometimes the B'nai Israel are referred to as an Am, sometimes they're referred to as a Kahol, sometimes they're referred to as an Eda. You didn't mention the word Eda here. So what does it mean each time when that comes up, and are there ramifications, are there repercussions in the scheme of what's being presented to us? You want to say something? No. Okay. We're going to move on now to the next little section which we have here, and so we're going to skip through all the senses. The senses follows basically through most of chapter 26. And we get to chapter 20, towards the end of chapter 26, on page 884, when Levi is mentioned. So we're told, Eilab Kudei HaLevi, and Lushachos HaGershon, Mishpachas HaGershoni, Kas and Merari. So we're told about the families of Gershon, Kas, Merari. Those are the sons of Levi. Eilab Mishachos Levi, Mishpachas HaLivni, Mishpachas HaChebroni, Mishpachas HaMachli, Mishpachas HaMoshi, Mishpachas HaKorchi, Ukahas Holid Es Amram. So these family names, Livni, Chevron, Machli, Mushi, Korach, what are these from? Those are some of Levi's grandchildren, right? I believe that Merari's sons were Machli and Mushi. Kahas, we know, are Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. So there's Chevron who's mentioned here. Gershon's sons were Livni and Shimi. So only some of them are being mentioned here. And then he mentions Zukahas Holidus Amram. So some of the families of Levi are mentioned in one capacity. And then we're told that Amram was born to Kas. B'shem Eishes Amram Yocheved Bas Levi Asher Yolado Usa LeLevi B'mitzrayim. And Yocheved was the daughter of Levi who was born to him in Egypt. Atela the Amram is Aaron, is Moshe, is Miriam, Achusam. And those were their children, as we well know. So the question here is that Amram is marrying his father's sister, it would seem. Right? Ukahas Holidus Amram, and Yocheved was the daughter of Levi. So what seems to be the problem here? what seems to be the problem. Who's he marrying? His father's sister, which would seem pretty, I mean, kind of incestuous, no? His father's sister, what? Right, it is before Matan Torah. That we can certainly answer it away. We don't have that. That's not our problem. But the problem, the question, nevertheless, is this a, you know, what kind of relationship is this? So that's where he goes in here. And I've seen this other places, but I figured I'd share it with you here. Lo hizkir sham yolata derech tzara. So he quotes Ibn Ezra, who says that her birth was not mentioned at the time when they came down to Egypt. And Rashi asif ishto yolata. That his wife gave birth to her. Whose wife? What's he referring to? Levi's wife. Okay, that he says in Sefer Yashar it says that Levi's wife's name was Adina Bas. Now this is not Yaakov Avinu, right? Because Yaakov is Ben Yoktan, Ben Aver. So in other words, Yaakov was a name which was around before Yaakov Avinu got the name, because that's the descendant of Aver. Hayisi Omer She'ena Mikra Katzir. Avalacious Levi Haisa Nikres B'Shem Osa U'Chashem Uta. So he says, what is he essentially saying here? That Levi, in one place, his wife is mentioned as she's named Adina, and another place she's named Ota or Uti. Ve'ev Shashayu Lo Shtei Nashim She'em Achas Adina V'Shem Hashinis Osa. So he says maybe Levi actually had two wives. Oshinashtana Shem Adina Bashem Osavia Min Osab Boker, I don't know, Lashon Knisa Ubiya, Vinikre Salshema Orishilata, but Khila Knisa Ubiya Mitzrayim. That she was named based on what happened when she gave birth at the time they entered Egypt. Vein Tana Mampike, Kidigushim, Matsanu Arbe, Tevos, Shehem Ludas, and Forsham Rakhlit Teferis, Hakriya. So he's just going into explaining how some words they appear a certain way, which they are, just to enhance the way that they're read by putting a dot in them. Matsanu Sham Aya, there's another name in Divrei Yamim Aleph. Vatorahi Bevav, Ubrosha, Ve'aya, Kain Unklos, Ve'yonatan Benuzio, etc. The point that I wanted to bring out here is something which I found in a different context, because I once wrote an article in which I asked the question about the fact of the matter is that Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam were products of a relationship which the Torah forbids. Okay, you can't marry your father's sister, so it's a forbidden relationship. Okay, but that only applies to a complete sister, to a full sister. In the case of Yocheved, it would seem from the possibility that he raises here, Efshar Shayulo Shtei Nashim, that Levi had Yocheved from a different wife. And therefore, Kehas and Yocheved were only half siblings. And as a result, Amram could marry his father's half sister because something through the mother, if it's not through the mother, it doesn't transfer in whatever way, whatever that means. But the point is that yes, so there are two points. One, It looks like it's a relationship that's forbidden by the Torah, but it's not really. And the other point is that even if the relationship is forbidden by the Torah, the fact that Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam are still revered goes to show how the Torah is actually consistent in two ways. One, like you said before, it was pre-Matan Torah relationship. And on the other hand, we don't shy away from reality. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam could still become what they became, even though they might be a product of a relationship which the Torah later forbade. Okay, which, you know, it's the same kind of thing that we'll say about Rus, right? Rus, the Torah looks like it forbids a relationship. You can't have a Moabite. So the answer is, first of all, it's not forbidden because Moaviva lo Moavis. It's a Moabite man who's not allowed in, not a Moabite woman, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the fact of the matter is that we don't shy away from David's reality. Even though it's something which looks like it's a little iffy, he's still Melch, you know, David Melch Yisrael Chavagayam, and nobody questions that. What do you mean?
Again, was it the product of a forbidden marriage?
Oh, right, correct.
Once he married
meaning two David, two sisters, right,
yes,
correct.
He
right.
Should theoretically not have married
Right, correct, right. And that is correct. And obviously, Yosef, nobody questions Yosef's status, and nobody questions Binyamin's status, and that is what it is. Okay, the last piece of narrative that we're going to look at now is the Tzlafchad story, or at least Tzlafchad's daughter. Tzlafchad's not really in the picture, and that is the beginning of Perek Chaf Zayin. Okay, so if you turn the page, we're on page 886. So we're told Slavchad's lineage all the way back to Menashe ben Yosef and his daughters. And the five daughters, they come to Moshe and Elazar and the Nisi'im and all of the Eda in front of the Mishkan. And what do they say? Avinu Meis Bamibar, our father died in the wilderness. Who lo ya badas betocha idan o adim laHashem badas Korach? He wasn't part of Korach. Ki vechetao Meis ubanim lo hayulo. He died in his sin, and he did not have sons. I can give a very long shiur about Slavchad's daughters and Slavchad trying to figure out what it is that they're talking about and what that means. Why do they say that he had nothing to do with Korach? He died in his own. Like, in other words, did he die? It says bechet omez. What is bechet? He died in a sin. Well, he died in a sin, then maybe he loses all of his rights. Ubanim lo hayulo. What does that even mean? So let's take a look at what the Iksav HaKabal says here. Okay, Rabbi Kiva Omer hu mekoshesh. Rabbi Shimon Omer mina mapilim. So two opinions, which are well known, are that of Rabbi Kiva, who says that he was the woodchopper, and Rabbi Shimon says that he was of the mapilim, the people who, after the spy episode, they said, "No, we're going to take over. We're gonna defeat the people in the land." It was too late. Umechilta Rabbi Yishim Yochai. The Mechilta says, "Meis b'midbar v'chi acharanin lo meisu b'midbar." Well, you think other people didn't die? Da'achir Rashi Le Amar Di'u Meis b'midbar v'hu Alef Uravavan Meis b'midbar. Because a bunch of people died in the desert. Alef Uravavan, right? Thousands, tens of thousands died. Some say that he was the wood gatherer. Some say something else. The ana hachi olifina tzavchad have the lo natarpume umlave lekabela de Moshe valeksi vayamas amrav Yisrael. That what did tzavchad do? His problem was a sin of the mouth, saying something about Moshe, and then when the pasuk says in Parshas Chukas. When the people died amongst the from the snake bites, Vayamas Am Rav Yisrael, he says that it was really somebody who spoke not nicely about Moshe, and it was really one person who died. Am Rav there, a great nation, whatever that means, was referring to one person. We begin the Chav Bamibar Bemelula Lagabe Moshe Chashivu De Moshe Antir De Bavu. So they felt that Moshe. That he had died because of something that he had said about Moshe. And they thought that Moshe had a grudge against what had been said about him. They didn't speak to Moshe first. What do? They go. So they stood in front of Moshe, but they stood in front of everybody else. In front of everybody else, they're not talking only to Moshe here. They're saying, "Avinu Meis Bamibar." Like this is, they're making a big proclamation. He died in the wilderness because you know he said something which was not very nice. But if you look back at that story, what is it that they said? You know, why'd you take us out of Egypt? But the whole snake story. So this is one view. This is one view which is espoused obviously by the Chilta. I've seen it elsewhere as well. So they bring it and they say, "Look, you know, there was no hard feelings." And there shouldn't be hard feelings. And they apologize. They say, "Ki dibarnu b'Hashem avach," that we spoke against you and against Moshe. And so what's their point here? They're saying, "Hu lo ya ba'das Korach." Right? It's one thing to say, you know, something stupid, which is really what happened with the snake story. It's another thing to be Korach. Right? What does Korach do? "You, Moshe, you're terrible, and not only that, you've destroyed these people." If you look in the story of the snake episode, that's not what's going on. And so what do they say? Al Hashem Badas Korach. Why do they say that their son was not their father rather was not part of the Kehila that was with Korach? Shayad Dinam Shiavod Bamanam V'cheirem she'achrimah Moshe Rabbeinu alav shalom ba'amro surun amal aleh anashimur shemayla. He says, if he had been part of the Korach crowd, then he doesn't get a portion in the land. That is lost on account of the behavior in that particular circumstance. If you touch whatever these people have, you'll fall with them. So don't do that. That they lost everything which they own. So they say, our father's sin was one in which, okay, he died, but he was not meant to lose everything, and he's quoting the Sephorno who says that. And of course, we know the end of the story. The end of the story is that they get their peace. Now, there's a lot more to be said about that. I don't find his perspective wholly satisfactory, but he seems to be going on the position that no matter who you follow, whether it's the Mikoshesh, or whether it's the Mapilim, or whatever it may have been, or whether it was the snake episode where maybe he was the only person who died, that his chait, his sin, does not take away from his rights to the land. And because he left the daughters, they should have that place on the land. Is there a better way to look at this? I mean, I'm just going to leave you with a teaser on this before we go into the last thing which we're going to have time for. We're only going to have time for one thing in the next section of the Torah. But the question is, Kivechet omeis ubanim lo hayulo. He died in his sin. Ubanim lo hayulo. And he didn't have to have any sons. There's one other time in the Torah where you have the phrase Ubanim lo hayu. Well, not lo, but it's lahem. Anybody know? One of the depictions of Nadav and Avihu, actually in Parshas Bamidbar, if I'm not mistaken, when they're mentioned, is Ubanim lo hayu lahem. And the question is, what does that mean?
That's when they died because they
used. Right. So one of the perspectives that the Midrash presents is that they died because they didn't have any sons. So is that saying that perhaps Safcha died because he didn't have any sons? Ridiculous, right?
Right.
Ridiculous. So
none of you actually didn't have any children at all over here.
No, he has children, gross. Right? So
yeah, he tried a lot.
Right, he tried a lot. Right. Yeah. Right, so I my own little insight is that the word chet here doesn't mean a sin. it's a divergence. In other words, the path is that you have a son and you give your land to your son. But his chet, it's not a sin. His chet is banim lo ayulo. That's his divergence from that normal, what's supposed to be that normal path. Okay, is it really a sin that he leaves these wonderful daughters? I mean the. So anyway, that's my tease. You gotta.
Be construed as the sin that because he had no sons.
So what I'm saying is that the word chet doesn't mean sin. Okay, that it means a divergence, because the truth is that's what the word chet means. When we translate it to mean sin, it doesn't always. That's not always true. It's a divergence from the path. You have to find other places where you have the word chet, and you see that it doesn't always mean sin in the traditional. You know, the way we think of a. It means a divergence. What's a sin? I should be doing this path. And then I go this way, I go this way.
It's not.
Right, right. It's not a good. An avera, an avon. Like those are more sinful kinds of activities than a chet. Okay. You know what? I think that I'm going to have to be kaivesh my yetzer, even though I really want to do more. We're really out of time. Mincha's in a couple minutes, and if I start one of these, we're going to be late. So we'll stop here. And but if you have the time and if you have the wherewithal to go through some of the things on Perek Chav Ches, I think you'll find it to be worthwhile. Okay, Yisroel Koyach, everybody.
Thank you.